SS race theory and mate selection guidelines. In this period of struggle for the future of our folk, you will become conscious, through the family, the clan, and beyond, of the bond that unites us all in an inseparable and sworn community of striving. Furthermore, you know that your life, your essence, all abilities and characteristics stem from your ancestors, and that you must take over the same role for the generations which come after you. You cannot shake it off. Rather, you have the obligation and the duty to adjust your life and live it accordingly. Consider, for once, what a tremendous revolutionary change has taken place in the thought and action of our folk in such a short time. After years of decline, new life courage, new life will and confidence broke through in the German folk on a wide front. National socialism has pulled up our folk from threatened annihilation, not only economically and politically, but also biologically. The answer to the question of how the Führer and his following could achieve such accomplishments is very simple. Adolf Hitler has again made the laws of life of our kind, whose observance is a prerequisite for any further development, the foundation of our thought, action, and feeling. What our ancestors, who were firmly rooted in the soil, instinctually recognized as right through the feeling of their kind, has, through the course of history, been partially erased and covered over by foreign intellectual and racial influence. The knowledge of the laws of life and awakened consciousness of our kind are today a certain signpost for our entire action. So, we want to look at the following described foundations of the laws of life of our worldview from the perspective of the great community of the entire folk and make the resultant duties of the individual a principle of our entire life. Then now follows a quote by Adolf Hitler. What is not of good race in the world is chaff. Close quote. The great number of life forms shows groups which more or less resemble one another and show common physical characteristics. They have the same nature, and we call such groups of life forms species. The mankind that is living today forms a species, for humans are fertile among each other. By the observation and comparison of a white, a negro, or a Mongolian, it becomes immediately clear to us that it is not enough to only speak of the human species. Rather, that for a more precise analysis, a further subdivision must be made. This leads us to the concept of human races. The individual races can be distinguished by differences which they have in respect to the uniqueness of their hereditary, intellectual, psychological, and physical features, tendencies, and characteristics. Each race has certain characteristics and features which are unique to it. These racial features are passed on to the offspring. Race is hence a group of life forms which distinguishes itself by the common possession of certain hereditary features. It always produces only its own kind. Or, in short, race is a characterized community of hereditary factors. As long as a race remains pure, its hereditary essence is passed on unadulterated from one generation to the next. It is hence necessary for the racial consciousness of humans of the same race to be raised and the dangers correctly recognized which lead to a mixing or an alteration, a degeneration and hence annihilation of the races affected. The predominant race determines the folkish character and continues its influence in it as a hereditary factor. As in the Germanic peoples, the predominant Nordic race gives the German folk too the predisposition of our kind. As long as a race remains pure, its hereditary essence is passed on unadulterated from one generation to the next. It is hence necessary for the racial consciousness of humans of the same race to be raised, and the dangers correctly recognized, which lead to a mixing, an alteration, a degeneration, and hence annihilation of the races affected. The predominant race determines the folkish character and continues its influence in it as a hereditary factor. As in the Germanic peoples, the predominant Nordic race gives the German folk too the predisposition of our kind. This leads us to the question, what is a folk? Each folk represents a visible community to the outside world. The same blood, the same soil, the same language, customs, culture, and history are an inseparable bond. For a population to become a folk, race, as well as history and culture, are necessary. The generation alive at any one time is just one link in the chain, which begins with the earliest ancestors and continues with the following generations far into the future. All of them together form the folk community. The existence of the individual is only then purposeful if it is innately bound with the entirety of the folk. The presently living blood carriers of this community bear the responsibility for the shaping of the coming generations. Each folk has its own unique folkish character, and the roots of this unique folkish character lie in the racial composition of the folk. Folk is a community of descent and of fate. As a hereditary community, it is large enough to be able to create and shape its own environment. The common heredity determines the physical and intellectual psychological abilities of a race. Race, as a practical concept, relates not only to the specially formed and working life force within us, but beyond that also to the highest value, to the concept of value, to the world view. There are races which can create high cultures, and those which can never elevate themselves on their own strength. There are races with heroic bearing, and those without the courage to fight. Cultural accomplishments are exclusively the creation of the higher races. The elevation of mankind continues or ceases with the preservation of the purity and of the strength of the culture-bearing races. The racial composition of a folk is unique. Its alteration always has a transformation of its nature and culture as a consequence. Each racial mixing always means a lowering of the worth of the higher race. Mankind displays strictly separated racial groups. Very roughly expressed, we distinguish between white, black, and yellow. Each of these groups in turn contains a number of sub-races with certain common features. In this case, one speaks of related races. Opposed to these stand the foreign races. Folks which, in regard to their racial composition, show the same elements as the German folk are of related race. To these belong the majority of the European folks. Since the racial core of our racially related folks is often very diverse, one must look quantitatively at the racial elements for the foundation of a distinction. in the Germanic folks, Nordic blood predominates in their racial composition. Their relationship to the German folk is hence referred to as being of the same breed. Other folks, which also show a small amount of Nordic blood, but which in their substance are not Nordic, are referred to as being of foreign breed. The existing positive racial composition of the German folk rests on the fusion of related races and the large predominant portion of Nordic blood. The main territory of the Nordic race encompasses the area of southern Scandinavia, Jutland, the North and Baltic Seas, and reaches into central Germany. Already in the earliest period, the Nordic man was a settled farmer. He invented the plough, which other folks later adopted, cultivated crops, and he bred pets. The explosive population growth of this Nordic mankind led to a new and necessary acquisition of space and caused wave after wave to stream down into bordering areas, into the European area and into the wide parts of Asia. The previous original inhabitants, even if often for only a short time, were imprinted with the mark of Nordic culture. Not from the east came the light, as was claimed by science earlier, but rather from the north came the strength. The Führer says in Mein Kampf, quote, "Everything that we today marvel at in the world, science and art, technology and inventions, is the creative product of few folks, and perhaps originally of one race." Close quote. The high cultures of the Indians, Persians, Greeks and Romans, created by the Indo-Germanics, clearly show the Nordic, or the modern Indo-Aryan, creative spirit. With the decline of the Nordic ruling class, they too again disappeared. Even today, we feel related to these cultures because they have a common racial origin. We are not so presumptuous, however, to believe that all cultures, even in earlier times, can only be credited to the Nordic race. Folks with other racial composition have also created cultures. In us, however, other feelings are aroused if we try to relate to the cultures of Old China, Babylon, or the old Indian cultures of the Aztecs in present-day Mexico and the Incas in present-day Peru. It cannot be denied. Those were also high cultures, but towards them we feel undeniably foreign. They are not related to us, but rather are of a foreign race. A different spirit speaks from within them. Never did these foreign cultures reach a commensurate peak with those based upon the Nordic spirit. The technological development of today has also emerged under the leadership of the Nordic race. This is just as much true, for example, in modern Turkey, the progress of America, and the rise in the Far East. Wherever mixed with closely related races, the influence of the Nordic race has always proved to be beneficial, and it has always developed abilities which produce the highest cultural achievements. Despite the often heavy mixture and meshing of races in the various provinces of the Reich, we find individual races more pronounced in the various parts of Germany. There are areas in which a tall stature, narrow face and light-coloured hair, eyes and skin predominate. These are the physical appearances of the Nordic race. Closely related to the Nordic man, perhaps only described as a variation of the same, but larger, wider and more stocky appearing, is Falish man. In many parts of the Reich, we find large people with a short head and a narrow face, large nose, brown eyes and black hair. This is the physical appearance of the Dinaric race. Or in individual areas are also found small, slender and nimble people with dark eyes and hair colour. This is the appearance of the Alpine race. Finally, conspicuous in certain parts of the Reich are short, round-headed people with wide faces, brown eyes, brown to black hair and dark skin colour. This is the physical appearance of the East Baltic race. In all provinces of the Reich, whether north or south, west or east, the Nordic race is more or less strongly represented. Many people in our folk cannot be absolutely assigned to one or another race. In each folk are found, next to the examples who are in appearance racially pure, the individual races in more or less mixed form. In the German folk, the Nordic heritage predominates. The Nordic race is not only the predominant race, it is also found in the blood of almost all Germans. Blood and soil are not empty concepts, but rather our destiny. Hence, the breeding goal of the German folk is also given. It is completed in the fulfillment of the laws of life of its predominant race. The portion of Nordic blood in the hereditary makeup of the German folk is about 50%. Furthermore, family trees teach us that each German actually has Nordic blood in him. So the German folk is, in the truest sense of the word, a blood community. History, on a racial basis, has long proven that the Nordic race has a much larger share of extraordinary men than other races. The Nordic race is above all the carrier of the high degree of ability of the German folk. Great deeds in all spheres have made it the leading race of mankind. There is no other human race which has produced so many extraordinary leaders, commanders and statesmen. In times gone by, Nordic man conquered large areas, founded states and created cultures. Already by around the year 1000, Vikings had landed in America. The opening up of entire continents was led by the Nordic spirit. One of the striking characteristics of the Northern race is self-control. Nordic daring is the foundation of the martial accomplishments of the Nordic races. Conscientiousness and strength of will, paired with reliability, greatly strengthen the drive for independence. These characteristics, however, reduce his ability to sympathize, and the danger is great that the Nordic man loses himself and expends himself. Nordic man possesses a great love for sport and competition. He stands there where one must dare. Therefore, he is also more frequently found than other men in those professions which are tied to danger. But here, too, is the important knowledge that more important than skin colour is the character of the man. One belongs essentially to the race whose virtues he professes through his deeds. If one examines the individual countries of Europe according to their racial composition, one initially notices that in almost all states the same races are represented. We find the Nordic race represented outside of Germany, in the Scandinavian lands, England and Holland, and even in Russia, Italy, France and Spain. We also find, however, East Baltic man in the various European countries. The overall racial evaluation of a folk does not come down to that. It is a matter of the strength of the portions of the individual races in the respective folk. And there we determine, already just numerically, The Reich marches far ahead of all others in respect to their Nordic portion. With natural right, Germany can claim the leadership of the predominantly Nordic Germanic folks. Then now follows another quote from Adolf Hitler. The strong must rule and not mix with the weak, and hence to sacrifice his own greatness. Each look at the world around us shows that offspring resembles their ancestors. From the sperm of a beech tree again grows a beech tree. Negroes breed negroes, whites always whites. Even in the case of very young children, their relatives notice, for example, that the nose was inherited from the father, the eyes from the mother. Later, other characteristics appear, like industriousness, talent, susceptiveness to certain illnesses. That an inheritance has taken place is ancient knowledge of man. Breeders have always tried to promote the passing on of certain features and characteristics, and to prevent animals and plants with undesirable characteristics from breeding. That this was a matter of development according to natural laws, however, has only been recognized and proven during the last few decades. Like every event in nature, heredity too is subject to unchangeable laws. The laws of heredity, like all other laws of life, have the same validity for plant, animal, and man. In the offspring, either the characteristics of both parents are again recognizable, or a characteristic of the father or mother predominate. Many times a characteristic can be traced through many generations, or it skips entire generations to later subtly again make an appearance. Heredity is hence the passing on of features and characteristics from parents to offspring. Not only physical characteristics are inherited, but also intellectual and psychological. Man possesses two hereditary factors for each characteristic. The child receives the hereditary factors in equal parts from the parents. A mixed breed can resemble a pure breed as a result of the possession of predominant hereditary factors in his appearance. The suppressed hereditary factors are not thus eliminated. They simply do not appear in that generation. What appears healthy on the outside can hide the covered over hereditary factors for sickness on the inside. One does not see what hereditary factors may lie in him. A purely external evaluation can hence never be conclusive. Two different races distinguish themselves through a great number of hereditary factors. By their mixture or crossing, these hereditary factors are randomly brought together, whereby in the descendants a great diversity results in regard to the hereditary makeup. The result of such a mixture is disruption of the continuity of the hereditary structure. The laws of heredity today form the basis of our knowledge of the formation and development of successive generations. Since normal and sick hereditary factors are passed on equally to the offspring, an enormous importance of the knowledge of hereditary factors and the duty to intervene and work to restrict and to promote for the formation of coming generations follows. At conception, essence and worth of a person for his folk and his race is already being determined. Certainly, education and environment can later develop and promote certain traits and restrain others, but only in that generation. But the fundamental essence remains unchangeable. Hence, the responsibility for the next generation lies with us. The right choice of mate is not only the prerequisite for the preservation of the species, but also for the continuance of high selectivity. It is the foundation of any racial higher development. The selection of a racially highly worthy wife, in itself, still does not necessarily mean an improvement of the race. That only comes when the right mate selection is followed by the breeding of an above-average number of children. For what would the elimination of bad hereditary factors from the folk help if, simultaneously, a reproduction of the good hereditary factors was not preserved and expanded? If, for example, mate selection was made by a man who did not want any children, then this would mean a deterioration of the race, because elimination of good hereditary factors from the future generation would result. If there were only physical differences between the individual human races, the question of belonging to a race would be rather unimportant. Therefore, the appearance of a man, which is given by the totality of visual features, characteristics, and abilities, must be kept strictly apart. The hereditary makeup of a person has a much greater meaning than his appearance. Often, it is extremely difficult to derive psychological disposition from the appearance of an individual. By heredity, chance may combine a preponderance of the physical traits of one race with the psychological traits of another race. In most cases, however, one will be able to figure the psychological disposition from the physical appearance, or at least approximate it correctly. Every person carries a great treasure of hereditary factors in himself from birth. In the course of his life, only a portion of them are realized. Environment has a part in the formation of the individual. Climate, nutrition, living space, position, etc., can have a visible influence on the development of a person. If a life form lacks the environmental conditions needed for it to flourish, then it is stunted. Its appearance is thus subject to many changes due to the environment, but not the hereditary makeup. Environmental influences are not able to fundamentally alter the hereditary makeup. The preservation of Germandom for centuries on foreign-focused soil is a visible proof of the strength of their blood. Due to lack of possibilities for development, the individual person often is sooner or later ruined. For the preservation and further evolution of a race, the necessary foundations for life must be present or be created. Hence are derived the following determinations. Number 1. Each person is formed by the cross effects of hereditary factors and surroundings. Number 2. The environment and its influence remain without effect on the descendants. Number 3. Acquired abilities are not inherited. The last fact is of especially fundamental importance. Through physical exercise, the muscles of an individual can indeed be significantly strengthened. The son of an athlete, however, does not, therefore, get stronger muscles than any average child. Likewise, intellectual knowledge is also in no way inherited. The son of a scholar has to start at the very beginning with the alphabet, just like every other child. The same is proven by the mother tongue, which has been practiced for many generations. Marxists and Democrats have, with much fantasy and one-sided overestimation of the effect of environment, believed that a change of this environment could improve the destiny of entire folks. For them, all the people are all the same. Hence, placed under the same conditions, whites, blacks, and yellows must also be able to achieve the same accomplishments in all areas. But we know better. racially and ethnically alien people can never become equal, even in the same living space and even over long periods of time. They always remain what they are, alien blood, which must be kept away from our folk body if it is not to slowly but irretrievably fall to destruction. The great folkish task, hence, consists of protecting the genetic mass of the folk from race mixing, to prevent the spread of genetic defects, and to shape the environment so that the best genetic elements of the folk achieve the greatest procreation. The laws of nature run according to an unchangeable, uninfluenceable will. They are valid for all life forms. It is therefore necessary to acknowledge these laws, and their observance must be viewed as the prerequisite for the preservation and further development of life. Failure to observe the laws of nature is followed by decay, deformity, and finally, ruin. National Socialism has made the re-establishment of the natural order of life a goal, and has given the necessary government recognition to the validity of the laws of nature for man. The law of fertility. Animals and plants produce more offspring than is necessary for their survival. Here are a few examples. A poppy produces about 4,000 seeds. If all the seeds grew and again reproduced, after 5 years there would be 256 million million poppy flowers. Already by the sixth year, the entire surface of the earth would no longer suffice to hold all of these plants. A single female cod contains 3 to 4 million eggs. After just a few generations of reproduction, the waters of the earth would be stuffed full of cod. Such examples can be expanded upon as much as desired. The enormous fertility, which we find in nature, again and again receives the necessary curtailment through the destruction of large numbers of individual creatures. The prospects of survival are not equal for all life forms. The fertility, however, is the prerequisite that a sufficient number of creatures remains preserved so that the species does not perish. Without fertility, there is no further development. The birth rate will determine the future of our folk. The number of cribs must be much larger than the number of coffins. Only then can we offer successful resistance against all arising dangers and turn into deed our right, which is due us on the basis of our leading position in Europe. The law of struggle and selection. We have gained knowledge about the development of life on Earth, largely through sedimentation and fossils. The examinations show again and again, in the oldest layers of the crust of the earth, very simply designed basic creatures appear. In later layers, we find more highly developed life forms, and finally, in the most recent layers, the most highly developed organisms. Development means change, growth, reproduction, expansion. Each development requires huge spans of time and knows no standing still. The life of the individual disappears completely in the evolution of the species. How does nature intervene in events and direct? If we go through the world with open eyes, we see that there is hard struggle everywhere, a struggle for existence or non-existence. Struggle is a fundamental law of nature. The deeper meaning of this eternal, apparent battle of annihilation is this. Everything weak or inferior is annihilated. Only the strong and powerful designs procreate. The goal is hence a selection upwards, the preservation of the best. We only have to correctly recognize the natural events and act accordingly. what our ancestors correctly understood instinctively, being much more strongly bound to nature, must again become our common knowledge. It is not a matter of the individual, rather the promotion and preservation of the species. In National Socialist terms, this is phrased like this. Communal good goes before individual good, or the individual is nothing and the folk are everything. Each folk needs space to live. Again and again throughout history, the struggle for living space occurs. The growing, healthy folk alone has the moral right to expand its living space and, if necessary, to conquer it. In nature, selection occurs through the struggle for survival. We must never carry over the concept of struggle for existence into economic life, however. We must only understand it in a purely biological sense. Artificial, often unnatural, selection takes place on a large scale in every culture folk. Intellectual inferiors, criminals, and sickly people are frequently saved from destruction. Thus, bad hereditary makeup is not only preserved, but also passed on to future generations. Medical accomplishments especially prevent a selection that once also applied to man. With nature-bound people of a similar culture, as we must view our ancestors, the same selective forces were in effect as with the animals. This selection developed man to a high state, but the rise of culture, and especially of civilization, allowed the laws of nature to be forgotten. Man can perhaps postpone their effect, but he can never eliminate it. Just as many species of animals and plants have become extinct over the course of history, so have entire folks been destroyed because they violated the laws of nature. Hereditary changes and environmental influences pushed evolution continuously onward. The formation and splintering off of new races was kept within bounds by nature through selection. In nature, those creatures unsuited for the preservation of each race were eliminated, while the carriers of favourable qualities remained. Selection preserves the race at its peak. The death of the individual creature has nothing to do with the essence of selection, but is only the means for it. Traits are gradually eliminated when they are no longer passed along to the same degree. Then, in the next generation, this trait is no longer strong enough to be represented. The effect is the same, whether this elimination is achieved through sterilization or abstinence, through death or otherwise. The most important selection is fertility. The person who has no children can have a long life, but he is forever purged from the life of the race. His genetic combination, working together with certain environmental conditions, represents something unique. The permanence of individual accomplishment, however, is only then secured if the creative person provides for the perpetuation of his work by descendants of himself. Fertility alone determines the continuation of hereditary makeup. Every selection which affects a folk is an enduring and irrevocable success or failure. With this knowledge, the main cause for the decline of ancient culture folks becomes understandable. In them, the carriers of industrious hereditary traits, the culture bearers and creators, were eliminated. The inferior won the greatest victory over them, the victory of a greater birth rate. During the Persian Wars, approximately 500 BC, Sparta had 8,000 combat-worthy men. But in the year 244 BC, only 700 were produced. The decline of Sparta and the collapse of Rome were nothing other than a failure of the fertility of the genetically able. It stands confirmed that all culture folks, especially the basically Nordic Germanic in character, are an example of reverse selection in regard to fertility. That means that the fertility of the capable is less than that of the less capable. The ever unequal reproduction of the capable and less capable, however, leads to a lowering of the superior hereditary factors in a folk, and invariably leads to its racial and hence cultural decline. Earlier, the fundamentally false view was often taken that higher ability was confined to certain classes of the population. And we have a quote here from H.W. Siemens: talent is a monopoly of a social class. In the National Socialist State, therefore, selection and state help are not based on rank or social class, but solely and limited to ability and accomplishment, industriousness and bearing. The National Socialist Education Institutes, the Adolf Hitler schools, the Langemark study and the Oder castles are living proof of this. They produce the future leaders of the German folk in all areas. The lower fertility of the Nordic-based folks is confronted with a high reproduction rate of especially those European folks which show Asiatic strains. In 1933, Germany's natural population growth, with 66 million inhabitants, was 233,297. In 1933, Poland's natural population growth, with 32 million inhabitants, was 402,465. The danger of a racial transformation in Europe is great. It is upon us now to prevent it. We know that the number of heads of a folk alone do not make up its strength or significance. But no one will deny that, next to the qualitative level, size and natural growth of a folk are the most significant foundations for its influence and power. Now we must look at war and reverse selection. Every war represents a reverse selection in its purest form. It is followed by more or less severe folkish biological damage for the participating peoples. Precisely the most industrious and most capable lose their lives on the battlefield. Germany lost 2 million of its best men in the First World War. 750,000 people fell victim to the enemy's hunger blockade. About the war and overcoming it in regard to population politics, the Führer said, quote, "The successful outcome of this war will give the German Reich tasks which it will only be able to fulfill through an increase in its population. It is therefore necessary that the gaps created in the folk body through the war be filled by growth in births." End quote. From the order of the Reichsführer SS of October 28, 1939, quote, "Many a victory of arms for a folk was simultaneously a devastating defeat for its life force and its blood. In this regard, the unfortunately necessary death of the best men, as regrettable as it is, still is not the worst part of war. Much worse is the absence of the children that were not conceived by the living during the war and by the dead after the war." Close quote. The sacrifices which this war demands of our folk are very painful from a human and a population political standpoint, but they are by no means senseless, because they have brought the life and future of our folk. They serve the security and defence of our natural right to life. The next subject is the dangers of race mixing. The irrational animal only joins with members of the same race for procreation. people close to nature, like the Germanics, the farmer who is rooted in the soil and close to the earth, who feels the call of blood and race, acted from the same instinct over many generations. Only the overly rational, cultured person believes he can act against nature. That will always be to his detriment. If two different races mix, their hereditary traits never merge into a new genetic mass that will be passed on uniformly. We know this from the study of heredity. We know that, aside from the coupling of certain genetic factors, traits are inherited individually and independently of each other. At the propagation of such bastards, these traits further separate and divide themselves up in the various descendants. Every racial mixing changes the harmonious balance of the racial makeup. The further apart in origin the mixing races are, the greater will be the disruption which such a bastardization has as a consequence. Furthermore, come all the disadvantages in the areas of health and especially psychology which result from race mixing. Mixed breeds are physically and psychologically disharmonious. Race mixing means a slow decline of the higher race and hence the sure loss of the uniqueness of a folk. The consequences of a harmful racial mixture are taught clearly to us by history. From the moment a folk loses its racial consciousness, a moral, intellectual, and cultural decline sets in. The popular opinion today that race mixing is culturally expansive and even culturally creative is totally false. True, on the other hand, is that contact with foreign races and foreign folks often first triggers in us the correct consciousness of our own essence. This knowledge, however, requires us to adhere precisely to strict separation of everything foreign to our own kind in racial matters. About race mixing, the Fuhrer says, quote, "Blood mixing, and through it the sinking of the racial level, is the sole cause of the dying off of old cultures." Close quote. A series of culture folks shows the following common path of development, which, however, does not represent a law of life. After a slow rise to a certain level, there follows a short golden age and then a rapid decline. The decline of strength is almost always introduced through the replacement of simplicity, sobriety, and health with pleasure-seeking, lack of principles, and sickness. Simultaneously, bloody wars eradicate the best carriers, and lack of children steadily reduces the number of the capable. The death blow, however, is dealt by mixture with foreign blood. It has the consequence that inner contradictions become even greater. With such division, it is then easy for a vigorous folk to triumph over the sickly one. The Nordic race is the carrier and foundation of the German people. Nature teaches us as a highest law that the individual is not the purpose, but rather the means of life. The German folk is not the sum of 85 million people, but rather a great oneness, a community, in which the Nordic hereditary makeup predominates. This hereditary makeup shows itself not only in physical form and appearance, but also finds its expression above all in a commonly directed racial soul. Not decisive, even if desirable, are the physically Nordic features of the individual person alone. Instead, it is his psychological character traits that are. The Nordic race is the race of the German folk. It impresses its stamp upon our essence. It determines our thought, action, and feelings. And now, the Jewish question. The destructive influence of race mixing with the Jews proved especially harmful in our folk until the rise to power of National Socialism. These parasites of mankind have well understood to the present day how to prevent a complete merger with their host folks. Representing this is the statement of the English Jew, Disraeli. Quote, "Every race must perish, which subjects its blood to mixing without care." End quote. If in the year 1928, for every 100 pure Jewish marriages in Germany, there were already 53 mixed marriages, then this proves how deeply this slow but steadfastly working poison has crept into our folk. Furthermore, there existed the special danger that Jewry, by means of spiritual decay, had begun to systematically undermine the racially conscious action and thoughts of our folk, in order to raise itself politically and economically to predominance. Alongside this undermining, miscegenation spread primarily in the intellectually leading groups of our folk. Jews made sincere feelings despisable, and their propaganda aimed intentionally at the inner undermining and fragmentation of our folk body. The after effects of this destructive, decades-long infection are even today detectable in our folk. It requires intensive effort to eradicate the last traces of this pestilence and lead our entire folk back to the natural and only correct path of life. The solution to the Jewish question has today become a vital task beyond the borders of the Reich for the peoples of Europe. After a short increase in the numbers of births in the decade after the 1870 to 71 war, the birth rate sank slowly until the turn of the century, and then descended faster. The causes of the decline of births. These are above all of a psychological nature. The declining birth rate started first among the wealthy, who, because of comfort and pleasure-seeking, were scared off from rearing the appropriate number of children. The broad masses, of course, then copied this example. Today, it must become the opposite, and in the wealthier circles, the number of children must especially increase. After the 1870-71 war, there were in Germany annually 40 births for every 1,000 inhabitants. At the turn of the century, there were only 35 births for every 1,000 inhabitants annually. The birth rate reached its lowest point during World War I, when it reached 14 births for every 1,000 inhabitants annually. Even more terrifying is the following picture of the decrease in births. 1870, with 42 million inhabitants, there were about 2 million births. 1933, with 65 million inhabitants, there were about 0.9 million births. The renewed positivity of the changed psychological attitude with the rise to power of National Socialism has brought a tremendous turnaround. These were 1933, 14.7 births per 1,000 inhabitants. 1935, 19.9 births per 1,000 inhabitants. 1939, 20.8 births per 1,000 inhabitants. This turn is certainly very encouraging in itself, but the increasing birth rate should not be overestimated. The numbers above still do not ensure the necessary increase of our people. This war is a great biological test of strength. The birth development in the last decade, however, clearly shows the new life will and life confidence which determined the turnaround in this sector. History proves, through many examples, that a folk can only harvest the fruits of its own industriousness and its strength of accomplishment when it has sufficient people at its disposal. The greater the space, the greater the need for people to protect this space, to ensure nourishment, and to produce industrial products. all folks, which for whatever inner reasons were no longer able to achieve an increase in population strength, simultaneously with the strengthening of their power, fell victim to annihilation. Let us look at the fertility of the European peoples. 36 to 37, Germany had per 1,000 inhabitants 19.4 births, Sweden 14.2, Norway 15.1, and England 15.5. In comparison, Poland had 26, Romania had 31, and the Ukraine had 34. The quantitative development of the Germanics, Latins and East Baltic speakers of Slavic language were like this. 1810, Germanic 59 million, Latin 63 million, East Baltic 65 million. 1930, Germanic 149 million, Latins 121 million, East Baltic 226 million. Projected for 1960, Germanic 160 million, Latins 133 million, East Baltic 303 million. The peoples of the Soviet Union are increasing annually by about 3 million. In the Asian area, Japan has doubled its population in the last 70 years. It has an annual growth of about 1 million people. Likewise, China and India are constantly increasing their populations, despite famine and pestilence. If we do not ourselves provide for the appropriate quantity of offspring and produce an increase of the Nordic hereditary makeup, then Nordic blood will become more and more displaced by Eastern and East Baltic blood. The Nordic race, or, we can safely say, the Germanic folks, march at the end when it comes to fertility. The number of births, however, decides the fate of folks. The German victory of arms is thus only a complete one if it is followed by the victory of the child. Quote, two weapons are at the disposal of each folk in the struggle for survival: its ability to fight and its fertility. Never forget that the ability to fight of a folk alone can never make it possible for a folk to survive into the far future, rather that the inexhaustible fountain of its fertility is also necessary. Close quote. By the Reichsfuhrer SS. Racial hygiene and population politics of the National Socialist State. The Führer says, in Mein Kampf, quote, whoever is not physically and mentally healthy and worthy must not perpetuate his suffering in the body of his child. Close quote. Above our action stands the folk community. It is an indefensible condition if the relationship in a state between the productive and the non-earning levels takes on unhealthy forms. The active, working portion of the populace must support the lives of those unable to work. There are lunatics who previously cost the state tens of thousands of marks. And in the Weimar period, the number of criminals was shockingly high, and criminals often heavily reproduced themselves. By eliminating these carriers of lazy heredity, millions can be saved and used for other purposes. The actions of any responsible state leadership must serve the systematic care and increase of those of good breeding. It is the duty of the state to undertake all things so that the people who uselessly claim the strength of others, and for whom life itself means misery, are not born in the first place. Every natural folk soon eradicates the inferior when it correctly recognizes this fact. In the so-called culture folks, however, a false charity carried into the broad masses, especially by clerical circles, downright promotes a reverse selection. From the point of view of the church, Any reasonable intervention is labelled a violation of the godly world order. It is plain nonsense to claim that God wants what we call inferior. Otherwise, we also would not have the right to temporarily or permanently remove a murderer or a criminal from the community. The laws of nature show us exactly that the life of our folk and maintenance of its good breeding stands above the well-being of a congenitally severely deformed person. Action must not lie with the personal I, but with the entirety of the folk. Furthermore, experience shows that most of the congenitally ill possess no sense of responsibility towards their descendants. In 1877, some 40,375 persons were cared for in German lunatic asylums. In the year 1926, it was 252,793 persons. In the USA, the percentage of the mentally ill has more than doubled between 1904 to 1929. National Socialism has intervened here appropriately. The position of the Führer towards this problem is clear and unambiguous. Quote, "The demand that it be made impossible for defective people to produce others just as defective as them is a demand of clearest reason, and in its systematic execution is the most humane act of mankind. It will save millions of unfortunates, undeserved suffering, and in its consequence lead to increasing recovery." Close quote. The German government created the Law for Prevention of Congenitally Malformed Offspring on July the 14th, 1933. The law decrees that whoever is congenitally ill can be sterilized through a surgical operation if, according to the experiences of medical science, there is great probability that his descendants would suffer from severe physical or mental congenital defects. The law lists presently known congenital illnesses, including a series of mental illnesses and severe hereditary defects, such as congenital blindness, congenital deafness, and others. Furthermore, those who suffer from severe alcoholism can also be made infertile. The Congenital Health Board decides about sterilization. With this legislation, the necessary beginning is made for the purification process of the folk body. The effect of this law will already be felt in the next generation. It was a decision of not to be underestimated significance that the National Socialist State put an end to this untenable condition with iron vigour. That moral offenders possess congenitally greatly damaged offspring is taken into account by a second law. The law against dangerous moral offenders and for the measures of security and improvement was created on November the 24th, 1933. Through this law, certain anti-social elements are removed from the folk body. On September the 15th, 1933, the Nuremberg Laws were announced as the Party Day of Freedom. They encompassed the following laws: the Reich Flag Law, the Reich Citizen Law, and the Law for the Protection of German Blood and German Honour. The Reich Citizen Law determines who is a subject and who is a citizen. Subjects are those who belong to the protective union of the German Reich and who are especially obligated towards it. Reich Citizen is the category of someone of German or related blood, who has demonstrated through his actions that he is willing and able to loyally serve the German folk and the German Reich. The Law for the Protection of German Blood and Honour forbids, among other things, marriage between Jews and subjects of German or related blood. According to the regulations of the Reich Citizen Law and of the Law for the Protection of German Blood and Honour, people of one quarter Jewish heritage are to be integrated through their offspring into the German folk. Therefore, the marriages between Jews and quarter Jews are forbidden, as well as between quarter Jews. Marriages between half Jews and Germans, or quarter Jews, require the permission of the Reich Minister of the Interior. The law also provides that marriages between people of German blood, with offspring of the miscegenated French from the period of the Rhineland occupation, as well as with gypsies, is prevented. The meaning of this legislation was summarized by the Reich Marshal. Quote, "It is an affirmation of the strengths and blessings of the Germanic Nordic spirit. We know that the blood sin is the original sin of the folk. We ourselves, the German folk, have had to suffer greatly from this original sin. We must, therefore, again try to make a connection with a line of generations from dark prehistory. It has truly been the salvation in the final hour, and if God and Providence had not given us the Führer, Germany would have never again arisen from this original sin, from decay." Close quote. A further measure is the law for the protection of the congenital health of the German folk, the Marriage Health Law of October the 18th, 1935. It forbids the marriage between people with hereditable illness and hence prevents the passing on of defective hereditary factors to the descendants. National Socialist Germany has naturally been sharply attacked by hostile Jewish-led foreign countries. Even though the Reich does not stand alone in the world with these measures, many states in the USA had already passed legal measures decades ago in order to prevent the increase of inferior hereditary factors. First, in 1926, such legal moorings were established in some American states, and in 1929 in Denmark and parts of Switzerland. In California, 9,000 people have been made infertile during the last 20 years. Racial consciousness and racial pride of the SS man. In the Reichsführer SS order of December 31st, 1931, it says in point 1 that the SS is an association of Nordic determined people, selected according to special standards. The principal point of our worldview is the idea of race. We have the unshakable belief that the blood, our hereditary makeup alone, is decisive for lasting and peak accomplishment. Hence, we place the idea of selection at the forefront of our ideals. Our ideal of selection is the physically and mentally, psychologically, hereditarily fit person of Nordic Germanic character. We do not want to be only an association of the physically best, but also the most loyal and most valuable in character. The preservation of the racially worthy for all future includes the family and the clan as a natural prerequisite. The life of the individual links him to ancestors and descendants. From the family and the clan, the union extends to the folk community. The individual person dies, subject to the laws of nature, but through the passing on of his hereditary makeup, he first becomes a living member of his folk community. We believe in the immortality of our folk. The Führer says this about the family, quote, "The destruction of the family would mean the end of all higher humanity. It is the smallest but the most valuable unit in the construction of the entire state structure." Close quote. The family is the life foundation of the Reich. It produces future generations. Each folk can only be renewed out of the family. From Germanic German feeling, we empathize with the idea of a clan. In close connection with the laws of life, by way of the German family, we have allowed for upward breeding. The family is a member of the sensible community of the clan. It is the acknowledged order for the propagation of the coming generation. Special duties of mate selection. We know that the selection of a wife gives us the only possibility in life to improve the hereditary makeup of the coming generation. Health or sickness, talent or inability of the descendants is determined by the mate selection of its ancestors. At this important step in the life of a man, position and wealth must not decide, but only mental and physical soundness. It is also clear that whoever is certain that he is the carrier of unhealthy hereditary factors must abstain. The Führer says in Mein Kampf, quote, "There is no freedom to sin against posterity, and hence against the race. What is being neglected in this area on all sides must be remedied by the folkish state. It must put race in the middle of life in general. It must care for holding the pure. It must declare the child the most treasured possession of a folk. It must take care that only those who are healthy produce children. That there is only one shame, despite one's own sickness and deficiencies, to nonetheless put children into the world." Close quote. It is just as much a lack of feeling or responsibility not to pass along good hereditary makeup by voluntary refusal, and hence narrow or even dry up the river of life. Accomplishment in profession alone is by no means the only one that the community needs. Just as important is fulfillment of the biological duty. Both together produce the German life accomplishment. The SS man should marry as young as possible. The mother of his children must be the carrier of worthy blood. Then his family is in every regard an enrichment of the clan and of the folk. In correct recognition of the future formation of our folk, towards which we must accomplish the largest part, the Reichsführer SS had already on December 31st, 1931, issued the betrothal and marriage order, and it states that 1. The SS is an association of German, Nordic determined men selected according to special standards. 2. In accordance with the National Socialist worldview, and in recognition that the future of our folk lies in the selection and preservation of the racially and congenitally healthy good blood, I am introducing marriage permission for all unmarried members of the SS, effective January 1, 1932. 3. The desired goal is the congenitally worthy clan of German, Nordic determined kind. 4. Marriage permission will be given or denied solely and only according to racial and congenital health standards. 5. Each SS man who plans to marry must receive marriage permission from the Reichsführer SS. 6. SS members who, despite refusal of marriage permission, nonetheless marry will be stricken from the SS. They will be given the option of resignation. 7. The appropriate processing of marriage requests is the task of the race office of the SS. 8. The race office of the SS will keep the clan book of the SS, into which the families of SS members will be entered following the granting of marriage permission or approval of an entry request. 9. The Reichsführer SS, the head of the race office, and the expert advisers of this office are obligated by their word of honour to silence. 10. The SS is aware that it is taking a step of great importance with this order. Scorn, mockery, and misunderstanding do not bother us. The future belongs to us. signed the Reichsführer SS H. Himmler. Furthermore, SS men standing before a commitment must again and again be reminded of the fact that an engagement too can only come after permission from the Reichsführer SS. From a 1935 speech by the Reichsführer, quote, "So, we are assembled and march according to irrevocable laws as a National Socialist Martial Order of Nordic determined men, and as a sworn community of its clans along the path into the far future, and we wish and believe that we will not only be the grandchildren who fought it out better, but, beyond that, the ancestors of later generations necessary for the eternal life of the Germanic folk." Hence, the guidelines for mate selection of the SS man are set down and the foundations created so that the SS directly does the main part in the formation of the leading clans of the coming generations. History shows us how often the rise and fall of flourishing empires and cultures has occurred in the course of millennia. Mankind owes its greatest accomplishments to the creative strength of the Nordic race. As soon as the carriers of this culture disappear, decay is unavoidable. In recent centuries, the process of de-Nordicization took on ever greater forms. We have learned the roots of the de-Nordicization and shown the dangers which today surround us. The National Socialist State has correctly recognized these dangers. Laws have already been created to prevent further decay, and measures are also underway to enlighten our entire folk in this sense. Furthermore, from us must come, if we really want to possess leadership in the Germanic space, an appropriate direction of all Germanic determined folks. In place of the de-Nordicization must come a conscious re-Nordicization. Biological insight demands a clear separation of the races. The disadvantages of race mixing are known to us. The great colonial activity through settlement of Nordic Germanic farmers in the East will form a wall against the advance of East Baltic people of the Slavic language. The SS has here too stepped into the front line for the solution of these life-critical questions and will, obeying its laws, fulfil the tasks placed before it. Insight and will for the promotion and strengthening of the Northern race, coming from our direction, will then become the common possession of all Nordic Germanic people. We know the path that leads to the ascent. We men of the SS carry along with the feeling of responsibility towards our own persons, above all, the feeling of responsibility towards the folk and the coming generations. The idea of race is the principal item of our worldview. Adolf Hitler will triumph in this struggle, not because he rebels against the laws of nature, but because he has again given them their due, and is willing to be unconditionally true to them. We want to be counted among the best of the Führer. To him and to our folk belong our entire devotion and loyalty. Our strength and our spirit will help determine and order the new racial reconstruction of the Germanic determined folks of Europe. And now, a summary of our demands. Number one, guard your health. And, as long as you are still at a developing age, practice a restraint. Above all, in regard to recreational poisons, such as alcohol or nicotine, and sexual activity. It must be remembered that the Nordic person generally achieves full maturity, especially late in development. 2. Marry as early as possible, Only then will you completely enjoy family life with your wife. 3. Do not marry a woman of foreign breed. You are responsible to your folk and to your offspring for keeping the blood pure. 4. Do not marry a congenitally ill woman, otherwise you can carry the guilt for the suffering of your own children and grandchildren. 5. Choose only a completely healthy wife for yourself. The true picture of the state of health and characteristics of your future wife are shown to you by her clan. 6. Your wife should be at least as racially worthy as yourself. 7. Endeavour to get yourself and your children back into the country. 8. Avoid marriage with a relative, because undesirable traits are almost always concealed from you, and then they emerge twice as strong in your children. 9. You must preserve your hereditary makeup for your folk in the largest possible number of children. It is in your children that you live on.